You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Carl Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
I'm not
pens.
Being sniffy.
No, I think you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
the monster is, of course, shunned and abandoned. And homeless.
I had a particular night with this very strange woman.
You know, there are many shades to my personality.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Sean.
I'm Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi.
Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
This is funny. I haven't done one of these yet.
Okay. So you say you grew up in Boston, but it was actually Cambridge. That's not the same as Boston.
Yeah, you can't say Boston. Cambridge is much cooler.
So were Matt Damon and Ben Affleck your babysitter?
You know, Ben and Casey's mom, Chris Affleck, was my teacher in third grade and fifth grade, and Casey Affleck was my first kiss.
Really? And I was joking about the Ben and Matt thing.
No, we went to the same high school.
And in the late 90s, at the very moment that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon got famous for Good Will Hunting, Sean Hader moved to Los Angeles for her shot at big-time show business. Of course, she worked crappy jobs, as aspiring actors and writers do, including as a hotel babysitter. And one of those jobs as a hotel babysitter inspired her new feature film called Tallulah. The title character is this young bohemian vagabond who lives out of her van. And one night in New York City, she is roaming the corridors of a hotel, scrounging for leftover food. A guest sees her and mistakes her for a hotel employee. The woman, the guest, is there to have an affair, but asks Tallulah to watch her baby while she does so.
Are you good with kids?
Oh, I don't know.
Can you watch her for me? I'll pay you. I have to go out tonight, and I can't take her with me. I'm a little nervous about her being with somebody else, but she seems to be comfortable with you already. So I think it's okay.
That is a scene from Tallulah with Tammy Blanchard playing your sort of Blanche DuBois character and Ellen Page being conscripted as a babysitter. So I guess it's not a spoiler, is it, to say then what Tallulah does?
No, it's in the trailer.
Okay. What does she do?
She, you know, the word has been debated a lot. You know, she kidnaps the baby, but she, in her mind, rescues the baby,
right.
I think.
From this woman who was clearly not prepared at that moment anyway to be a mother.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this was based that the germ of the movie came from a moment that I had when I was working as a babysitter in LA for all of these high-end hotels.
When you were a newly minted college-educated actor, moved to L.A. to become an actor, but instead
I was in New York. I was working as an actor. I moved out to L.A. I was making ends meet. And I was not Tallulah, but I was certainly, you know, driving a $500 Buick and the driver's side door didn't open. So valets would have to crawl through the passenger side to take my car. I was, you know, definitely of a different socioeconomic level than most of the people whose kids I was watching.
And did you encounter some people who were that terrible?
Yeah. I mean, I would say for the most part, people were great. And, you know, but I also did witness a kind of neglect that was occurring at this high level of society that, you know, people were staying in the penthouse suite of the Four Seasons, which was whatever, $4,000 a night, but they didn't know how to take care of their kids. And I had a particular night with this very strange woman. And that line is almost verbatim.
You mean the line is verbatim of, oh, just can you take care of this? But that can't be it because you were the babysitter.
She seems so comfortable with you already, so I guess she's okay.
Yeah. It's like a cat. Oh, she likes you.
Yeah, and you know, I was 2 minutes into the room, and it was I got home. I was really heartbroken, and by the end of the night, and she had come to the hotel to have an affair. She hadn't brought her nanny.
In real life. Oh, but you could also be describing the film.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really pulled a lot from this one evening. Yeah. But she returned at the end of the evening and she was drunk and passed out on the bed. And I really desperately wanted to steal that kid.
Wow.
And I didn't, but I ended up writing about
writers it. Writers, obviously, all, writers of all kinds, fiction writers of all kinds, take material from their life, from things they overhear, they see. Rarely are they so frank and transparent about, like, the entire premise and opening scenes of this film are from life.
This is
verbatim, practically.
I mean, it's a wish fulfillment moment. It's a moment that I had where I thought, I have to take this kid and I would do a better job than this woman, even with all of my, you know, I had a total lack of resources at that point. I was living in a tiny studio apartment. All my furniture was from the trash. Like, I didn't have any resources. I was in my 20s, you know, lost person, really. And I really wrote the movie from a place of judgment. Yes. I mean, I thought this woman should not be a mother.
Right.
And not all women were meant to be mothers. And then in the course of trying to make the movie, I became a mother.
Right.
In retrospect, it's very interesting that I wrote a film all about motherhood before I was a mother. And
like long before you
long were before. Yeah. And I'm quite relieved and grateful that it took as long as it did, because I think I rewrote the film after the birth of my daughter because I had a lot more empathy for my villain.
Right.
And I understood her and I had compassion for her. And so the script changed and suddenly it wasn't such a clear, this is the villain, this is the hero kind of story. It was much more complex.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that I told that story.
Interesting. So you had studied acting. You were an actor. And then you were getting parts in the aughts, I see. You know, you were on this series and that series. At what point did you decide, I'll take an acting part whenever I can, but what I really want to do is direct and write?
I think when I got raped on TV for the third time. I mean, I sort of joke
Law
about that.
Law and Order something?
I mean, honestly, yeah. I, as a woman, and most of what I was going out for was guest spots and, you know.
Right.
You come in and you're the victim and you have bruises on your face and you cry and you tell some horrible story. And there was a moment that I had, I think I was on Numbers and I had been raped and the director was pushing me to cry more. And I thought, I'm so grateful and lucky that that hasn't happened to me in my life. And here I am sitting here trying to pretend that it has. And it, I think it was a frustration with the kinds of roles that were available to me. But then more so, it was my interest in telling the whole story.
Right.
It's that I grew up doing theater. My interest in acting really came from theater. And some actors, you put a camera in front of them, they really come alive.
Yes.
You see there's an energy to them. I remember reading an interview with Jane Fonda, and she talked about the lens of the camera and getting energy from the lens of the camera. And I didn't feel that way. I felt like the camera was a black hole that was sucking out, you know, all ability to be free and play and
right.
all of that stuff. And so I think I was just more interested in, I was always on set. I never wanted to go to my trailer while they were setting up the lights. I wanted to see what the DP was doing. I wanted to know what kind of camera he was using. I was interested in the whole process of film, and that's really, I wanted to be the storyteller.
And if you had, if history had happened a different way and you'd been cast in some show and it was huge and you were huge and you were a big famous actor at 28, I mean, would you have missed the thing you should have done? I mean, directing is what you should be doing instead
directing
of acting?
Directing is always what I should. I had people, you know, I had, when I was a kid, I orchestrated my birthday parties like they were these epic kids coming to my birthday party would get a character description and a full bio and then their relationship to everyone
and
else
a little
at
trailer.
The party. I mean, they would have to come in costume and character and stay in character for my entire birthday party. And I would write these massive plays almost that kids had to come. I mean, it was like this mini dictator.
Yeah.
But it was always, I was always sort of interested in narrative and writing and create storytelling. So yes, I think had I stayed an actor, it would not have used the best part of me.
Right. And you have had this successful career as a television writer, including on staff for the first three seasons of Orange is the New Black, which everyone loves. And you wrote one of the earliest and certainly most talked about episodes of that show that featured this transgender character, Sophia, that Laverne Cox plays. Here is a clip from your episode. And I guess a heads up for listeners, this gets pretty graphically anatomical.
The bottom line is that the prison can no longer provide high-end hormones.
If I don't get my medication, I'm going through withdrawal. Hot flashes, night sweats, My face will sag. My body hair will start to grow back.
Okay, we don't need to get into
it. Let me explain this for you. When my penis was split in half and inverted, my testes were removed. So I don't have any testosterone left to replace the estrogen that you've taken away from me.
What do you want from me?
That's Michael Harney and Laverne Cox in Orange is the New Black. Now, this was before Transparent was on, and so had TV viewers really ever seen a storyline featuring a trans character?
There were no trans characters. Right. I mean, there had been one on Dirty Sexy Money. There was one trans character, but when I went to write that episode, I was so fearful, honestly. I was not part of the trans community. I didn't know, you know, I was writing this very nuanced, deep character, and I went and met with a lot of trans people and people that were transitioning. I talked to support groups in LA. You know, and I remember talking to one of the women who was running a support group in LA, and she said to me, it's so great that you're doing this trans character and we need that. Can she not be in prison? And I said, well, no, she has to.
Where we do this show.
She has to be in prison because everyone's in prison. It's a prison show. And she said, well, then can she be innocent? Because, you know, we have so few depictions of trans people on television that, you know. And I said, no, she can't, because she's a human being who made mistakes. And I think that's what people responded to so much about that character, is she was flawed. She was a real person. There wasn't this martyr, you know, token, we're going to show this person, but she's not going to feel real.
Well, where historically, as various different ethnic and other groups have become mainstreamed in show business ways, first they have to be perfect people. Then we can show them with their warts and all.
But, and it's been a flaw, I think, of you know, nobody wants to be a token or be a symbol or be, you know, and actors are looking for these complicated, flawed, morally ambiguous, you know, I'm like, yes, we're showing this person and we're showing her and she's, you know, married and she's having trouble with her wife and her son hates her right now because he's traumatized, because of course he is. He's 11. You know, I think so, having these kind of dynamic conversations and then having feedback from trans people afterwards who felt like, thank you for
really
pushing that forward.
You didn't get, I mean, given that you disobeyed the request to make her nicer and better, you didn't get pushback or you're horrible from the trans community?
I didn't. It might have been out there. It wasn't coming at me. I would expect via Twitter or somewhere I would feel that. Yes. But I didn't feel it. And I'm so grateful. And to look at the movement that happened, the cover of Time magazine with Laverne Cox, the Transparent coming out, this conversation, the awareness that has become part of the zeitgeist, and to feel like I had a tiny little piece in that process is so fulfilling.
And so now that you've made this very good film that no doubt many people will see and will get great reviews, and you have this television career, I mean, given your absolute druthers for the next 10 years, are you mainly a film director or also a television creator?
I would like to create a television show. I certainly have. I think it's exciting time for TV. There's so many outlets. It's how people are consuming media and story. I think those are my main interests. I think I'd like to direct films and I'd like to create a series. I think they're split, and I don't know how to do them both at once and be a mother to two young children, but that's the goal.
You're having it all.
Having it all is so damn tiring.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
It's a very good film. Sean Hader's movie Tallulah is in theaters and streaming on Netflix right now.
If I could be, baby, where you are.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was fun.
It was indeed.
I can't believe you got me to reveal that I kissed Casey Affleck. I thought we weren't being
there recorded. There you go. Call People Magazine right now.
Oh, my God.
If I could see, baby, what you see.
Coming up, literary scholars have been analyzing Mary Shelley's Frankenstein for 200 years. At this point, Is there anything they could have missed?
I feel like the conventional readings of Frankenstein are somewhat stale, and that this, the environmental reading, the ecological breakdown reading, is a new one, and it's really a reading for the 21st century.
What Frankenstein can tell us about climate change and the refugee crisis. The past speaks to the present. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
Maybe you read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in school. If you did, and you remember anything other than the monster, which has probably merged with the movie versions in your mind by now, you remember that technology plus hubris equals catastrophe. But if that's all you got out of Frankenstein, you may be missing a major part of what the author was intending to say. Because beyond the story, the monster's creation in the novel, the creation of the novel is pretty fascinating as well. And there may be some important clues for understanding it. The whole thing started exactly 200 years ago this summer, and Eric Malinsky takes it from there.
It was a dark and stormy night. I know that's the ultimate cliche, but if there ever was a story that began on a dark and stormy night, this would be it. It's June 16th, 1816, when Mary Shelley started writing a novel called Frankenstein.
It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
But here's the funny thing. Usually we celebrate the year that a work came out, which in this case would be 1818, because Mary Shelley spent 2 years writing Frankenstein. So why are we celebrating the moment of inspiration? Because on June 16th, 1816, what was happening not just in Mary Shelley's room that night, but around the world, might actually offer us a glimpse into our future. Now, Mary Shelley was famous long before she wrote Frankenstein, or famous and infamous. At the age of 17, she fell in love with a 22-year-old aristocratic poet named Percy Shelley. He was already married, so the two of them fled to Paris, leaving Percy's pregnant wife behind. It was a huge scandal. But they weren't alone in Europe. They actually had a posse. There was Mary's half-sister Claire and Claire's lover, Lord Byron.
So they all met in Geneva.
Charlotte Gordon wrote a biography of Mary Shelley.
And at first they stayed in this posh hotel where all the English stayed on Lake Geneva. But there was so much gossip about them, and it was so uncomfortable. No one would speak to them. So Byron rented a villa called the Via Diodati, which is still standing. It's privately owned, just up the hill from the lake.
And we have detailed notes about what happened because Byron brought his personal physician, John Polidori, who developed a hard crush on Mary Shelley, and wrote obsessively in this journal about her and all the goings-on in that cabin.
I think that all of this also contributed to this incredible, I don't know, charged atmosphere.
Yeah, this had all the markings of a hot and steamy summer by the lake. But it didn't turn out that way. It actually turned out to be very, very different. Gillian de Arcy Wood is the author of Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World.
The largest volcanic eruption of the last 10,000 years on the planet Earth occurred 6 degrees south of the equator in what was then the Dutch East Indies and is now Indonesia, a small island dominated by a large volcano called Tambora, which exploded with extraordinary fury. The volcanic matter in the atmosphere formed a 100 megaton sulfate aerosol layer that then enveloped the entire planet, and plunging the world into a 3-year period of extreme weather, in particular a kind of global cooling effect.
Europe's experiencing frosts in June and July.
Ron Broglio teaches environmental literature at Arizona State University.
And it's having a real effect on the crops. 1816 was just absolutely devastated, so we had a lot of food shortages.
Now, the eruption happened the year before, but the worst of the after effects were hitting that summer. Torrential rains rampaged through China and India. The press at the time called it the year without a summer. And back at the lake in Geneva, The weather was ruining the plans of Mary Shelley and her friends.
It rained and rained and rained and rained. And, you know, you really can't keep people like Byron and Shelley cooped up all day long. They get impatient, restless, up to no good.
Charlotte Gordon says they plowed through every book that they brought with them. And finally, in the middle of June,
when it was really stormy and they were really bored, Byron had been reading to them from some ghost stories, and he finally said, oh, these ghost stories just aren't even scary. How about if we all try and write a scary story ourselves? And so everyone separated that night. Here's what happened. Byron tried to write a ghost story and got bored and went back to doing what he did best, which was basically writing about Byron. Shelley started trying to write a ghost story, and same thing happened. He got bored and went back to writing basically about Shelley. But Mary started writing a ghost story, and she did not stop.
We witnessed a most violent and terrible thunderstorm. It advanced from behind the mountains of Jura, and the thunder burst at once with frightful loudness from various quarters of the heavens. I remained, while the storm lasted, watching its progress with curiosity and delight. As I stood at the door, on a sudden I beheld a stream of fire issue from an old and beautiful oak which stood about 20 yards from our house. And so soon as the dazzling light vanished, the oak had disappeared, and nothing remained but a blasted stump. When we visited it the next morning, we found the tree shattered in a singular manner. It was not splintered by the shock, but entirely reduced to thin ribbons of wood. I never beheld anything so utterly destroyed.
That passage from Frankenstein describes something they actually saw near Lake Geneva. And Gillen says the motif of lightning runs all throughout the book,
which Percy described as a storm-lashed novel.
A flash of lightning illuminated the object and discovered its shape plainly to me, its gigantic stature and the deformity of its aspect, more hideous than belongs to humanity, instantly informed me that it was the wretch, the filthy demon, to whom I had given life.
Now, obviously, there were a lot of things inspiring Mary Shelley beyond just the gloomy weather. The news at that time was full of all these stories about this new technology called electricity. And earlier that year, she and Percy had traveled through Germany, past a castle called Frankenstein. But when Gillen reads the novel, he sees a reflection in the crisis that was unfolding in Europe in 1816 after all that volcanic ash had blacked out the skies and destroyed crops.
The numbers of peasants who abandoned their farms and took to the roads were described as armies on the march. I mean, with tens of thousands of people displaced. If we think about the Syrian refugee crisis today and the tens of thousands of people making their ways across the highways and byways of Europe, that gives us some sort of image of the level of civic disruption. And seen in that light, you remember the novel, and the monster is, of course, shunned and abandoned and homeless and turned away from towns and cities and is essentially a kind of refugee, that captures, he symbolizes the human crisis that was unfolding before Mary Shelley's very eyes.
I am malicious because I am miserable. Am I not shunned and hated by all mankind? You, my creator, would tear me to pieces and triumph. Remember that and tell me why I should pity man more than he pities me. Shall I respect man when he condemns me? Let him live with me in the interchange of kindness, and instead of injury, I would bestow every benefit upon him with tears of gratitude at his acceptance. But that cannot be. The human senses are insurmountable barriers to our union.
Like the monster at the center of the story, it took a while for Frankenstein, the novel, the phenomenon behind the novel, to really catch its footing. There was an 1883 stage adaptation, and of course the movie from 1931. But it was really the atomic bomb and biotechnology that finally cemented Mary Shelley's reputation as this prophet against scientific hubris. The Year Without a Summer became just a footnote, a piece of trivia. But Jolinda Arcee Wood wants to bring it back, front and center.
I feel like the conventional readings of Frankenstein are somewhat stale, and that this, the environmental reading, the ecological breakdown reading, is a new one, and it's really a reading for the 21st century.
Now, of course, the year without a summer was very cold, and our climate is warming up. But Gillen says 1816 and 2016 still have a lot in common. Temperatures being wildly unpredictable, massive storms erupting around the world. Also, look at how the weather of 1816 affected Mary Shelley psychologically, I mean, where her imagination went. In that summer, her cabin mates, Shelley and Byron, wrote the darkest poetry of their careers. If our weather keeps going haywire, we might all feel like the people in that cabin in the summer of 1816.
This psychological dimension of climate change has been neglected, and it will create a kind of, I think, collective nervousness and anxiety that it's impossible to predict exactly what they'll be. Will it spur incredible creativity and innovation, and will we adapt well, or will the stresses of climate change bring us undone somehow?
For Mary Shelley, it did spur creativity and innovation. She turned a gloomy summer into an opportunity to write a masterpiece. And 6 years later, after Percy Shelley drowned, she decided to dedicate the rest of her life to establishing their reputations as deep-thinking writers, not just star-crossed lovers.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, right? And it's part of her romantic self-fashioning. What kind of self does she want to create for herself?
Ron Broglio says that theme runs throughout all of her work.
Other worlds are possible, not simply the world we live in. And as a fiction writer, certainly that's important. But also, interestingly, I think as an ethical person, that becomes important. And if we talk about adaptation and sustainability, that's certainly the case. To be able to see or imagine or project out or to model, whatever language you want to use, to imagine those futures. And then I would just extend that to say, and to imagine them not only for ourselves, but for those who are radically other than ourselves, for the monsters, for those that can't find refuge.
Thanks to Eric Malinsky for that story. It also ran on Imaginary Worlds, which is his podcast about sci-fi and fantasy. And Lily Dormant read from the novel.
Don't you ever feel guilty?
I feel guilty.
Guilty.
I'm guilty of the same foolish whimsy.
Guilty?
Guilty.
My name is Kelly Pratt. I'm a musician. I have a band called Bright Moments, and I've played with a number of other artists, including Beirut and Arcade Fire, David Byrne, St. Vincent. My guilty pleasure is the Eagles, Already Gone.
The Eagles suck.
What you think about the Eagles?
It sucks.
I hate the Eagles. God, do I hate that band.
Eagles suck, bro. Deal with it!
Because I'm all...
People really hate the Eagles. They're, like, not a cool band to like. First of all, Southern rock is not really that well respected amongst, like, indie rock people, hip-hop people, electronic music folks, you know, classical music, jazz folks. Like, it's very popular amongst, you know, a lot of people, but it's not taken seriously.
Well, I'm running down. Seven women on my mind.
Along the same lines, you know, there's a reason people don't like the Eagles so much in a lot of Southern rock. It's because it's so ubiquitous. You hear these songs over and over and over and over again.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy.
And, you know, you can only hear them so many times before you start to hate it. When I gave this song a second chance, I was in the grocery store. Here in Portland, like, a lot of the grocery stores will play Animal Collective and Elliot Smith and cool music. But if you go to the Safeway, they're playing, you know, Eagles. First listen, this song is pretty straightforward, standard Eagles. It's a guitar-driven rocker, standard breakup lyrics, a lot of patented Eagle-isms in here. But when you start to pay attention to it, there's a lot more little fun stuff in there. Aside from the real long guitar solo in the middle of the song, there are a number of real short 1 to 2 bar guitar solos at the end of each little verse phrase. Those are pretty tasteful. There's a couple of them that are quite weird. Almost avant-garde. It's probably interesting to call the Eagles avant-garde in any way. The other thing that really takes this song to the next level for me is after the third or fourth chorus, I believe about 3 minutes and 20 seconds in, there is a modulation, otherwise known as a change of key. So this is really common in pop music, particularly at the end of a song. Think I Will Always Love You, Whitney Houston. There's a whole step modulation near the end of that song. And I will always love you. I will always... Golden Lady by Stevie Wonder. The last couple minutes of that song is a continuous series of modulations of a half step up. But this Eagles modulation is an interval of a fourth, which is quite large of a modulation for a pop song. There's one other I can think of, Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. Now that song continually modulates a fourth throughout the whole song and makes it a bit of a gimmick. But in the Eagles song, yes, it really takes it up a notch and really sends those vocals soaring towards the end for the last couple of choruses. So... that's my guilty pleasure, Eagles, Already Gone. Listen and enjoy it afresh.
That was Kelly Pratt. So now I want to hear about your guilty pleasure. What is that song or movie or novel or building that is considered completely uncool by all the smart people, but that you absolutely love? Tell us what your guilty pleasure is and why it is as well. Record that manifesto on your phone using the Memo app and send it to studio360@wnyc.org. Or you can just write us a message about your guilty pleasure at our website, which is studio360.org. And we may ask you if we can put your story on the air. Coming up...
you.
You did steroids? They make your balls shrink?
Oh, you think that's funny? How about I show my balls right here and you can tell me if they shrunk, huh? No, for your information, I have full-size balls. Next question.
To achieve the kind of uncouth, un-PC regular guyness that permeates almost all of Danny McBride's characters, He and his co-writer have a very specific approach.
I think it is. You know, and for us, it's like we never really look at this like it's a straight comedy. We honestly approach the writing as if it's a drama that has dick jokes in it. And so...
I'll talk with Danny McBride about Vice Principals, his latest drama with dick jokes. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
Danny McBride has pretty much made a career out of playing total jerks that you kind of love anyway. Egomaniacs like Kenny Powers in the HBO show Eastbound and Down.
I'm very upset with how I'm acting right now. I just have a very hard time expressing my emotions, and I can't stop from yelling.
Or self-centered, spiteful losers like his character in the movie This Is the End.
I'm not an idiot. I know why you guys don't call me or hang out with me anymore. Because I party so hard.
But for all the foul-mouthed, all-American, lunk-headed bravado of his characters, they're also often sad and kind of sweet and vulnerable. At least just enough so that you don't completely despise them. He's got a new show on HBO called Vice Principals. He is its co-creator, co-writer of a lot of the episodes, and its co-star. He plays a vice principal at a high school in South Carolina. And speaking of school in the Carolinas, McBride's main collaborator on this show and most of his other projects is the writer and director Jody Hill, who was, it turns out, his freshman year roommate at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts.
You know, on Vice Principals, everyone from writers to the editor to the production designer to camera operators, they're all guys that we went to school with.
Really?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
You know, I think it really started at that school. You know, I think we knew that we were so far outside of the industry and we were sort of in this bubble in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, that it just created this work ethic where we always just helped each other no matter
right.
what. If you had a pull cable or, you know, how to go make a run or give a note on a script. Like, everybody was just always involved in everyone's projects, and that work ethic sort of has followed us where anytime anybody, you know, is ready to do something, you have all these guys coming out of the woodwork that we've worked with for years.
And you were making films as an undergraduate, right?
We were. You know, I had a buddy that had gone to NYU, and I that just wasn't in the cards for me. I just didn't have enough money to go to a school like that. And when I was applying for film school, you know, he had just graduated from NYU, and he was just kind of telling me how he was like 50 grand in debt because of his student loans. And he was just kind of hemming and hawing about how the rich kids at his school had the best movies, and so much of it was money-based. And I knew that that would not be an option for me. And School of the Arts was pretty incredible for the fact that when you made films there, they paid for your movies and you were not allowed to add anything to that budget. So everybody was on the same playing field. And it was cool. I think it prepared us for the world as well, that, like, you know, in independent cinema, you have a number and you have to stick with it. And I think that, you know, it helped groom us to be responsible filmmakers, I guess.
And your final film, your like senior thesis, was this movie called Eddie Noble and the Heroes?
Yeah, it was a superhero movie. Yeah.
Well, actually, we've watched it. We dug it out of the archives at
How dare you?
Alma mater, and hear it, and let's play a little bit of it for the listeners.
Oh no,
Eddie, come on, man, I'm scared.
Yeah, I'm scared too, Carl. But I just realized it's not because of Kate or Killian. It's because of what will become of us if we go back out there. I mean, what's out there for us guys? College and some desk job.
Eddie,
and then...
really, we don't have time for this. Let's just go get some help.
We'll call the cops.
What are you guys talking about? We don't have time for the cops. I mean, we're the only ones who can stop him. If we go back now, he wins. I mean, guys, we've trained our whole lives for this. I mean, we wanted this more than anything in the world. I mean, if we go back, the superhero thing is over. We'll never know if we had what it took, so I'm going back.
So that was Danny McBride's first film, or first major film, I guess.
Riveting. I don't know if it's major, minor.
But it's not short. It actually lasts
20 minutes.
Yeah.
20 minutes, yeah. It probably feels like it lasts an hour, but, you know, that's by design.
No, it's complete. It's so sweet. It's about these, you know, young people being superheroes, and it's so kind of earnest and sweet. More sweet and earnest than... you have been known for since.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there are many shades to my personality.
You contain multitudes. I see that. So you go to this film school. You make this 20-minute film. It's sweet. It's funny. It's amusing. It's charming. Did you feel like, okay, I can do this now? I'm going to be a filmmaker and an actor?
I never thought I would be an actor. I really always imagined it would be behind the screen. And, you know, it's just something I've been passionate about since I was a kid. I mean, we would make, you know, home movies. You know, as soon as somebody got a video camera in our neighborhood, we would begin that stuff. And so it's just something I've always wanted to do. And, you know, I moved out to L.A. and a bunch of these guys came with me. And David Green, though, he graduated a year before us. And right after graduation, he brought the independent film George Washington to Winston. So we all like graduated from film school and then all worked on George Washington. And I was one of the second unit directors on it. And but that was a really good experience because I think it showed everybody that like, look, you know, David's just like us and he just made a film and people are seeing it. And it really was the spark that was needed right at a crucial moment to keep you invested in this dream.
You finish college, you move to L.A., you're earning a living as best you can in working in crews of essentially reality TV. Was that a happy time?
Definitely when I first moved to L.A., those first 3 years were like the hardest years of my life. I mean, I moved here with a girlfriend and then 3 months later I just had friends. And and I was working at like the Crocodile Cafe in Burbank. I was the night manager at a bar in Holiday at the Holiday Oof, Inn. And,
those sound like Danny McBride character jobs.
I've lived it. And, you know, then I was also a PA. I worked on a show called Battle Dome. And so I was just sort of just trying to make ends meet any way I could, and then I would escape every night when I'd come home and try to write. And so it was definitely a tough time. And L.A. is a hard city to be in if you're broke and you're not doing what you want to do. And so those years were definitely rough. But, you know, I think that's good. It all just builds character.
So after that, you made your first feature film with Jody Hill called The Foot Fist Way, in which you play this martial arts guy who is clinging to his job as a teacher because it's the only place he gets any respect in life.
And when you find a wife, you watch her. You don't believe a single word she says, because at the core, people are shit. The only person that you can trust is me, your Taekwondo instructor.
And then the two of you and Jody Hill, went on to create the HBO series Eastbound and Down, where you play the ultimate egomaniac, Kenny Powers, this washed-up, former baseball player still trying to get back up in the world.
I'm the man who has the ball. I'm the man who can throw it faster than
So why do you guys like writing and you playing these characters who are so not great examples of American manhood?
You know, we sort of started this kind of storytelling back on Foot Fist Way, and it wasn't really something we had explored really in school or before that. I think it was kind of a byproduct of living in Los Angeles and trying to write what we thought the studios wanted. And there would always be these notes about likability and what sort of qualities a main character had to have.
Yeah.
And I think we took that as a battle cry. We think that people are open-minded enough that they don't need a checklist to invest in someone, you know, that if you can find that identifiable trait, even in the worst person, that's almost what makes this worth doing. And so I think that's kind of what we started to do, was like, you know, let's take these characters that are unlike us or unlike people we'd ever want to spend time with,
right,
and let's figure out a way to make them human beings.
That's really interesting, given that they are said in one way or another, the likability or an insufficient likability of characters is the kind of ultimate standard studio note. Which is what is so interesting about your characters, is that even though they're complete jerks, you bring these glimpses of humanity that let us empathize with them a little. Like in the first episode of Vice Principals, where your character has this terrible moment where he's explaining to his ex-wife's boyfriend and his daughter that he did not get the principal job he was up for.
They gave it to somebody else.
Oh, Neil, I hate that for you, man.
Why didn't they choose you?
Well, baby, when you're the person enforcing the laws, you don't get to make a lot of friends. Not a lot of people like me.
People like you?
No, I know it's hard to believe, but they don't.
That's Danny McBride with Shea Whigham and Maya Love in Vice Principals. Neil Gambi has a lot of flaws, but he's nowhere near as awful and unlikable as Kenny Powers was in Eastbound and Down. How come?
I think it's honestly just to make him identifiable. It's to make him a layered character. You know, I think that with Neil Gambi, he's a lot different than Kenny Powers in the sense that I think Neil really does think that what he's doing is in like the best interest of the school, and he's just very misguided. I think he is aware of you know, that he's not very likable, and I think he compensates by like trying to put up the wall of a tough guy. And you know, but I think it all is masking just great disappointment. You know, he's somebody who comes from a failed marriage, and he's worried that his daughter is going to invest in the stepdad more than him, and he doesn't have the respect he thinks he deserves at school. And in essence, that's what this whole show is ultimately about. It's about when we kind of find these shortcomings in our lives, it's very easy to like to make an enemy and to say that that person's responsible for it. But ultimately, it's kind of like you need to take a look in the mirror a lot of times.
That's unusual for a comedy, isn't it?
I think it is, you know, and for us, it's like we never really look at this like it's a straight comedy. We honestly approach the writing as if it's a drama that has dick jokes in it. And so
yes, it does. And much other profanity. But then, of course, dramas have profanity as well. Your character has these wonderful, elaborate, profane exchanges with the other vice principal, who is played by the extraordinary Walton Goggins.
Why is this job so important to you, Gambi? Is it because you got absolutely all else going on in your life?
You wish you had my life.
A divorce loser is what you are. Look at you. Just rock hard at the thought of all that power.
I know you like to think about my but don't. It's private property.
Eat Gambi.
No, thank you. But have fun imagining it, though.
I mean, that are those written? Because they go on so crazily long, I could imagine that they were partly improvised.
They're written, but then we'll also kind of toss those around. And like, you know, Neil Gambi is not supposed to be very intelligent, and so he definitely doesn't have a quick wit to him. So a lot of times when we'd get into those things, I would like what was written was almost too witty for him. And so I would just take those out and just sort of try to stutter or just try to repeat back whatever the insult was that Walton threw my way just to make it sound just clunky and just like this guy's not good at doing this.
Right. This profanophilia, if that's a word, is a thing in your first film and with Jody Hill, The Foot Fist Way. The main character, Fred, as he's finally leaving his wife, who has been cheating on him throughout the movie, says this.
I don't care if you wake up in a ditch with grown men shitting on you and jumping on top of your head.
Maybe your nose will turn to a big old dick and you can stroke that all the time.
I hope your hair turns into dog one day.
Now, I mean, it's just so kind of baroque and crazy. Why do you love those things so much?
You know what's funny? I think it's because my friends swear so much that we don't even really realize how much we're putting in the shows until, like, my parents will call and be like, God, you guys have to cuss so much. And I'm like, are we cussing a lot? I didn't know that we were. And then it's like, oh, yeah, we've cussed a lot in this. I don't know. I feel like Southerners can cuss in a way that just almost makes it sound like poetry. So I think we just kind of channel that.
You have children now, small children. When do they get to watch your shows?
They don't ever. even when they're grown people, I'll have it banned. I have a 4-year-old son and a 1-year-old daughter. And, my son was actually able to see the first thing that he's ever been able to see with me, which is the Angry Birds movie. So that was a big moment for us.
There you go. Danny McBride, it has been a pleasure. And I can't wait to see the rest of this season and this series.
Thanks, Luke. I appreciate it.
Vice Principals is on HBO right now. And that's it for this week's edition of the show. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week with a whole new one. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Studio 360 Show, on Facebook, on Instagram, on, I'm sure, every social media platform there is or will ever be. The show is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kestrel Wolgaroo,
Joaquin Kotler,
Juliet Muller,
Emily Marinoff.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks again for listening.
So I'm going to go ahead and go, but I'm not going to stop yelling because then that'll mean I lost the fight. So please leave a key under the mat. I love y'all very much. Peace out.
PRI, Public Radio International.